Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryan Karavavahai Tejasvinavati Tamastoma Vidivishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Okay, page 2. Okay. I guess. Okay, there's another reason for establishing the Samanvaya of Anyatraiva Prasiddha category of words. The Shrutis say that it is incumbent on us to know that all names and characteristics belong to the Supreme Reality, without any exception whatsoever, and that at the same time the Supreme Brahman is without flaw. Right? So then we have to establish that the all words, all meanings, all what's important within the Vedic literatures is all Vishnu. So that means then you're going to have words that may be used in another way. Like when we say Indra, then that generally always means the demigod Indra. But it also, but the point is that potency is Krishna. So we have to understand that. At the same time, is Brahman is without flaw. Right? So Indra has flaws, but that's because of him as a jiva, not because of the portion that is representing the Supreme Lord. Does that make sense? So the free will of the living entities, that's what creates the trouble. Does it make sense? Yeah. Moreover, such knowledge is indispensable for the attainment of liberation. Right? Because why are we involved in the material world? Because of seeing things separate from Krishna. When we see everything connected with Krishna, then we're liberated. We're transcendental. Right? So for the... Yes.
We discuss this now because that's relevant for the next...
No, but it starts here. No, it's relevant here because now we're going to look at the Lord from this Anyatraiva Prasiddha.
And previously we used to look at the first and second?
With this Anyatra Prasiddha. Not the Anyatra Prasiddha, not Anyatraiva Prasiddha. Right? And also this Ubhayatra Prasiddha. Like that. We were looking at those. Things that are in general not taken to mean Brahman, but you without any difficulty would see it that way. Right? And then you have those ones that it has multiple uses, so using it as Brahman or using it in an ordinary sense, and that's pretty standard. Right? So now it's the thing is generally it's never used to mean Brahman. Does that make sense? So it's just you're just switching. The understanding of the word just becomes more and more difficult. Right? Does that make sense? Because the whole idea is that if it's tattu samanvayat, about understanding the Lord as the central point of all aspects that the Shastra is talking about, then that would mean then we have to be able to see all these different things in connection with him. And then the living entity and the material energy are simply taking part within that. That's why we say it's the Lord's material, the pastimes of, you know, creation, maintenance, and destruction. Because the jiva can take part in that. But otherwise, the modes of nature, everything go on nicely. Right? It's not... We have the idea, no, because man's there now, we perfected the world. But if we look any place where man is not involved, then we generally find out to be a perfect, pristine, you know, it means it's definitely going to be in National Geographic. You know, they find a spot that no man has ever gone. It's in National Geographic. Doesn't matter where it is, it's already good. Right? And, you know, living entities have been living there for millions of years, and everything says fine. Right? But add mankind, and then things, you know, may get better, may get worse. You know. So that's the whole thing, is that he does everything perfect. It's only when the conditioning of the living entity, that's the problem. But it's not the jiva as specific, it's the conditioning of the jiva that creates the problem. So, yeah. Yeah.
For the second class, which is the example, you know, which fits into it?
The second class.
Yeah, Ubhayatra. And it says that Pada 3 is related to Ubhayatra, which we saw just recently.
Pada, which?
Pada 3, dealt with the second class.
Yeah, so what does Pada 3 mean?
Yeah, we were dealing with Dhara, the thumb, and all those different adhikaras.
So yeah, when you say someone's the size of the thumb, so then that can mean either the Lord, he's known as the size of the thumb, and the Smurf is known as the size of the thumb. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, you know, it's a common thing. Things are the size of a thumb. Like that. I think also, was it Thumbelina? She was the size of a thumb. Yeah, you know, so, you know, it's a pretty standard size, right? You know, you never hear of anybody the size of your knee or something like that. Now, if you're Irish, you might be kneecap, but never the size of your knee, right? Does that make sense?
No.
No.
It says over here, it refers either to Brahman or to other things and principles.
It means something that the word is a word that has multiple applications, and people are comfortable with all those applications. Does that make sense? So the first one, the Anyatra Prasiddha, means that generally it's taken in an ordinary sense, but if you refer to it in a transcendental sense, no one has a problem with it. It's just generally they don't use it that way. You know, it's just like you say, you know, I'm going to take my car, or I'm going to take my wheels, or, you know, take my ride, or, you know, have all these things. But if you say, take your automobile, yeah, we understand it's an automobile, but generally we don't use it that way. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point, is that we generally don't use the word to indicate Brahman, but if you say it's Brahman, no one has a problem with it. The second one means it's a general word that's used however people need to use it. So if it's about transcendence, it's about you know, ordinary things, no one has a problem with it. It doesn't have a specific application. You know what I'm saying? It can be used in any variety of ways. The third one is, generally it's always used to mean something other than Brahman. But technically, because of the nature of Tattu Samanvayat, it also is meaning Brahman. So it needs some explanation to bring about our understanding of it in that position. Does that make sense? So that's why this one being more difficult, because we're not used to the word being this way. Right? That's then why then it's being dealt with last. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so then we dealt with this Anyatra Prasiddha, means in its Namatmaka Shabda, means its proper names. So people are used to those names like that. So then dealing with them, the proper names, then we've shown how is Vishnu, right? Then when you do into this Lingatmaka, then that's descriptive, so that may have the more narrative aspect, and so then people would either try to take it literally or would use this descriptive element to take it out of context and mean something else. Right? So then, in other words, the direct and indirect meaning of the word in the first context. The second one, because it's just general, then it's not a big deal like that, however it's used. But the point is, you're saying it's this, but in people also use it like that. So they're just using it like that instead of like this. But this third one, then it's like, this always means this. Why you're saying it means that. Does that make sense?
Maharaj, Can we say, for example, that like jiva in previous ones, we always use jiva refer to living entities?
Yes, but the discussion wasn't over the word jiva. The discussion was over greatness or, you know, all-pervading or supporting the world. You know what I'm saying? Not that the word jiva wasn't there, but the argument wasn't based on the word jiva like that. Now it will be. Because there it was, we talk about the word jiva's there and then all these other attributes. So then they're going to try to take those attributes and use them to mean jiva. But here now we're even going to use the word jiva and its meaning, the Supreme Lord. Because if we say, jiva who maintains everything and who does like that, because jiva means who's the life of something, right? Who's the life of the universe, right? The Lord, not us. So that's will be the meaning here. Generally that context we're not used to. You know, does that make sense? Or let's say, just in our own practice, right? That when you say the word Brahman, right? You have to bring yourself to the level of Brahman. Generally, we will think, oh, that's Mayavadis. We won't interpret it to mean just that you're bringing yourself to the transcendental position. In a sense. So that's, we will always interpret. That's this third one, Anyatraiva. But now we've seen is how it's being discussed in the Vedanta Sutras, how it's being discussed now in these, you know, later cantos of Bhagavatam. Because it's bringing out that from the transcendental platform, when you're liberated, that's when you can really appreciate Krishna's name, form, quality, and pastimes. Because before that, it becomes clouded by our own conditioning. Right? So, coming to that, then when you come to the liberated platform, on that platform you can function. Because the point is once entrance into the Lord's pastimes is happening from the liberated platform, not from the condition. From the condition through sadhana, you can get yourself up to that liberated platform. But still within that liberated platform, that then you have to then pursue to get prema. So now we see is that shift has come to that point, and we see in this, especially from the ninth canto. We saw it before that, seventh, eighth, you know, occasionally. You know, seventh, rarely, eighth, a little bit more, ninth, very regularly. For Prabhupada's using the term, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, you know, which generally we always attribute, again, to Mayavadis. Because for them, that's a Mahavakya. For us, it's not a Mahavakya. Right? Om is the Mahavakya. Why? Because Om is the Lord, His energies, the living entity, His pastimes, His paraphernalia, the whole thing like that. So then we're bringing out is that everything is Brahman. If you see everything is Brahman, that will bring you to the liberated platform. So that's why this section and this particular thing is important. Because normally we won't interpret, right? It means, in other words, a misunderstanding of this is then while devotees will say, oh, I'm just being practical, or, you know, I mean, it's just, that's just life, you know, we have to, you know, like that. Sadhana, okay, we understand that as directly, we always interpret that. But anything outside of sadhana, we generally define that as mundane. And it's something you have to deal with, and so we have to be practical, therefore, so the interpretation of the indirect, or how Krishna, you know, Krishna opens the Chaturshloki is that He is everything. So that's where the philosophy actually starts. Then of your values within that, that's then how you'll that's where you'll see the Lord. Right? So each individual will see the Lord differently because their values are different. But everything that you seeing everything's the Lord, that means anything anyone can value, then that's that element of the Lord. Right? So we're talking about actually an advanced level of understanding, a very essential point, how everything is Krishna. Right? So in the Chaturshloki, the first verse where he says he is everything, that's what we mean, that's what the Upanishad means by Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. Right? So then in the Bhagavatam, then it's given as the Chaturshloki. So this kind of interpretation generally is not there. We're saying it where everybody's comfortable with it. But if I talked in the same way, I went to some other temple and started like that. If there was anybody there that, you know, how you say, felt, you know, that they were, you know, well-read and studied, they'd probably have so much trouble with it. Right? You know, so what, and then you'd have to explain. Right? So that more obscure understanding. Because in the material world that Krishna is everything, that's obscure. But we find that for the pure devotees who come to the material world to preach, they only see Krishna. They don't see anything else. So for them, this third position is how they always see everything. Now when they explain it, now whether they're dealing with someone else qualified, they will deal on that third level. Otherwise, they'll use the first and second for explanation. So we're used to the first and second. It's only been introduced here in the Vedanta Sutra where we're seeing the discussions on this more technical level, on words and all this. You know what I'm saying? That makes sense?
And just to add to this particular point, you mentioned about jiva, you know, that how we are going to see that it belongs to the third class.
Yes.
In Bhagavatam, Canto 10.
I would say third group.
Third group.
Yeah, not third class, because it's not that it's third class, because you'd have to have a more first class point of vision to be able to understand this third group.
Yeah, so in Bhagavatam 10 Canto, Chapter 1, one of the purports, you know, Prabhupada mentions that Pumsa means Krishna, but in a general sense, Pumsa means jiva. You know? But this
yes,
is not the word Pumsa is being used in the.
Yes, this is that way.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's a standard way of dealing that you'll see in the Upanishads. For other things, you generally won't take that. Right? It means if you're dealing with the Purva Mimamsa, then you're going to be interpreting the words in there either generally on the first category. Right? Means in its ordinary sense, how it's just normally seen, non-transcendental. Now, whether it's direct as proper names or descriptive, so namatmaka or lingatmaka, like that, that would be there. Or if it's just a general word that is used in the correlation of different ways, then because you're doing yajnas and rituals, then you'll interpret it according to the ritualistic sense, even though the common man may, it also has some other meaning. Like that. But since they're in the context of rituals, then of course it'll be seen that way. But they don't have a problem that ordinary people use it in a different way. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? No. But, yeah? You know, it's just like let's say we're cooking a cake. Okay? So, you know, we look in the oven and the other person asks, well, is it baked yet? Right? And so it's not that we're looking at it, and if it's floating inside the oven, then we say, yes, it's baked. You understand? Like that. We just use it in the context of cooking. Does that make sense? Okay. That made sense to anybody else? So. Only you got that? So. Yeah. Okay. In other words, it's just used in that context. Well, outside of that context, then people may use it in another way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Or, you know, you go outside, it's so hot. You know, if you go out now, you're going to get baked. You know, like that. So, things like that, people are... You don't mind, because if you're talking about temperature, then you look at it that way. But when you're talking about the other, then you're going to mean... You understand? Yeah. So for the Purva Mimamsas, then they're basically going to use these first two. The third one, because they're not actually interested in transcendence, so why should they ever translate it in that way? Right? Does that make sense? And for the Mayavadis, they're also going to do the same because they're just trying to prove that they're Brahman, right? So then in context where you could use it in the other way. So these rare ways, then they're not going to use it generally. Though, if they need, they will use it just as desperate means, right? But for the Uttari Mimamsa, then this hidden meaning, that's going to be more prominent. Because that's what it is. It's not about the world. It's about what's behind the world, the metaphysical and the transcendental. So more on the transcendental, but the metaphysical will be your basic platform. You know what I'm saying? So in Brahmanas, it's just going to be the physical platform. In the Upanishads, it's going to be the transcendental. the Aranyakas, that will deal with the metaphysical, like that. It'll be referred to by the other two, but it's not prominent. Okay. Like that. If then certain words offering special difficulties for Samanvaya, like Avyakta, Jiva, Dukhi, Badha, and Panchajanaha, are left out, the principle of Sarva Shabda Samanvaya in Brahman would be carried out only partially and not in its entirety. Right? So, saying that all Shabda, all sounds are referring to the Lord. Right? Because we open up the Sanskrit text that Narayanad Udbhuto Yam Varnakramaha means the letters, everything's coming from Narayana himself. Like that. So the whole point of Shabda, it all comes from the Lord. The Veda comes from the Lord. So if it comes from the Lord, it's non-different. That means every syllable means the Lord. It's just that since you're dealing in the material world, then you're dealing with not seeing the Lord, that's the illusion. So generally you would tend to, if you could, if you didn't need to, you would not see it in connection to the Lord, because as soon as you remind yourself of the Lord, then that means you're not the Lord, and that's not a popular position, right? We want to be the Lord. Does that make sense? And in the spiritual world, it may be used in an ordinary sense because it's dealing with the secondary, which is in service to the Lord. So they may use it that way, but it's not that they don't use all the other meanings also. Right? It just depends upon the situation. Mother Jashoda and that, things are generally more direct. But, you know, pleasant, the cowherd boys, it'll be direct. It doesn't necessarily have to be that pleasant. Servants, it'll be direct, it'll be official. Does that make sense? Like that. And then for the gopis, then they may use direct or they may use indirect. So if they're amongst themselves, they can use both. And if they're around others, they'll generally always use indirect. So they'll present it that it means one thing, but it means something totally different. So we see the acharyas, like you see Rupa Goswami in Nectar Devotion, and quote himself mentioning or quoting from other scriptures or acharyas, that that Krishna or the gopis are saying one thing, and so by that meaning, it means something. But they're actually meaning something else. Like that. So then this principle is being used. Like that. Because it's all connected to Krishna. So in the spiritual world, it's all connected to Krishna, but because it's about performing the activities, then it may be about the aspect of the sat and chit aspect of Krishna, not the ananda aspect. Right? So they'll use the indirect, that they're talking sat and chit, but they're meaning ananda. Does that make sense? Because Krishna, his position, his existence, what his activities, that everybody's comfortable with. Those are the obvious. But the ones that are not obvious means his activities with the gopis, that nobody else knows about. So that you have to deal with indirectly. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Would it have been better described in Swahili? Oh, okay. Just making. Yeah, that.
Purnimamsa would mean.
Ooh, the elephants are getting bigger. Wow, the little elephants really big.
Fence is getting smaller.
Oh, the fence is getting smaller. I was thinking, wow, they grew like about 2 feet. The fence is smaller. Okay, thank you. I was thinking, wow, what are they feeding these guys? You know?
Purva,
okay.
We will attribute the 5 schools to Purva, 1 to Uttara, and Mayavadis will be just in their own category.
Well, it depends.
If we talk about what we talk about.
No, you would say is that 4 are less than Purva. Okay. They're less than Purva, because see, Purva means the whole Veda. All the verses of the Veda. Let's say we're taking Rig Veda, so 10,000 verses. They will, or 10 or 12, they'll interpret all those verses according to their philosophy of Purva Mimamsa. So for karma. In other words, every word that's there, you know, how do you say it? So it's Atato Dharma Jigyasa, right? They're going to interpret everything that way. And they have no problem working with any verse. Before that, the first four schools before that, they only select those verses that specifically support their philosophy. They just don't deal with anything else. That's why Purva Mimamsa can defeat all the other four. And yoga.
And yoga.
Yeah. So that they, so it's there. Now Uttara means then you deal with Upanishads, because they interpret everything according to Brahmanas. That's why it's called the Purva. So the Samhita, the Veda itself, the verses of the Veda, and then the Brahmanas that explain how to use those verses in for sacrifice. Right? So in other words, that part. So they're looking at it, the Brahmacharis learning the verses, and they as Grihasthas are then applying it in Brahmanas.
So that's Vedanta.
No, that's the Purva. Yeah. Then, Uttara means then the Aranyakas and the Upanishads. Because then you're looking at the metaphysical and philosophical understanding. So that's then beyond. That's for Vanaprastha Nyas. Does that make sense? So in other words, the path what do you call it? Pravriti. That's the Purva Mimamsa. And the path of Nivriti, that's the Uttara. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? But here they're interpreting Brahmacharis as in training to be Grihasthas. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at, if it's a Brahmachari who's Naistika, he'll be counted as Uttara. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Mayavadis?
Mayavadis would be in Uttara. So you have six schools of Vedic philosophies, right? Then within Vedanta you have six schools, mm-hmm. right? So Shankara is one, then the four Vaishnava Sampradayas, then Govinda Bhashya, the Gaudiya understanding. So you have six commentaries on Vedanta Sutra. So within Vedanta you get the six. So that's why then sometimes when we say the six, we're including ourselves, so it's one proper and five, you know, how you say, materialistic. But sometimes it'll be in, you know, mentioned about the six schools as all being bogus. That means then you're talking about Shankara as representing Vedanta. Right? So if the Vaishnavas are representing Vedanta, then we'll say Vedanta's correct. And then the others are there. So in other words, if it's proper in Vyas, then it will be proper. If it's Shankara, then it's considered one of the six bogus. Does that make sense? So that's why you have an overlap in definitions there. So sometimes you see that it's, yeah. Okay. Less means they use less verses. Everything's based on the Veda, all the schools. That's why then they're considered, what do you call it? Gnostic, right?
Or
agnostic. What?
Gnostic.
Yeah, means they accept the kinds of the supremacy, they accept authority. They're not making up their own from the basis from there. Their interpretation, that's then what's has the problem. So some aspects of what they're doing is proper. So in other words, the logical aspects that Gotama defines, that all schools use. Because it's proper, it's Vedic. Just the conclusion that through logic then you can get yourself to the supreme position, now that's a problem. You understand? The atomic theory of Vaisheshika, that we don't have, no one has a problem with that, and that everything's made out of atoms. But that getting everything back to atoms, that's when it's going to how you say, make everything work, then that we would, how you say is incomplete, right? First off is, you know, where's Eve, right? You know, so then you have to get the whole package, then you have to have the Garden of Eden, then you have to have God, you know, so the whole thing has to go there. So he just leaves that out, it's just about Adam, right? So that way then we're just, it's incomplete, right? Shankya, that the universe is constructed out of these 24 elements, that no one has a problem with. Now, whether they define them as 24, sometimes they compact them into each other so that there's 16 or there's 9. Like Lord Brahma uses 9. But that means everything else is included within. Does that make sense? So within mind, you have, you know, intelligence, false ego, impure chitta, like this. You just have all that in there. Within the gross and subtle elements, you also have the tan matras. So it's just a matter of how you do expand it or contract it. But the concept that everything is analyzed according to the elements, not the atoms. That's what is called, you know, how you say, that group. It's not that Vaisheshika aspect. But it's that the concept that there's earth. Now, of course, earth is made of atoms, but we're not worried about that. Okay? Does that make sense? You know, so then the whole, how you say, yeah. So that breakdown, that everybody uses to analyze the universe, right? Yoga, how the mind is elevated, that you have to use all these steps to become like that. Everybody uses that. But they'll use it in their specific fashion. They won't use it to that, that emphasis as the Astanga Yoga system will use. But otherwise, those eight platforms, until you get to that, how do you absorb yourself? Right? Does that make sense? So when they're describing any of these, they're correct. It's just that they don't, you know, it's just like, let's say you have the crazy teenager, okay? Then how does the car work? Okay, you put the key in the ignition, you turn it, the motor goes on, you push the little pedals, it starts and stops it like that, this little thing here, you move that and it makes you go faster or slower, and this thing here, this big round thing that you move right and left makes the car go right and left. Is that correct? Is there anything wrong there? Is there any flaw? No, but now what's their interpretation how to use that? Oh, go out and go, you know, ride around the town and get crazy. That's where the flaw is. But the mechanics of it aren't wrong. So that's the thing, and that's why we say all these six schools, the mechanics are correct. Just their, what is their purpose of that mechanics, that's where the flaw is. That's why then you see, we'll even use the arguments of one school to defeat another school, because it's just, you know, that's the argument. So Vedanta includes all of those, but it's since it's already been given by the other acharyas, then out of respect there, you use it that way. Just like for Gotama, we don't use other words, we use his words on how the Panchanga Nyaya works. Does that make sense? So like that, it's so, yeah.
Yeah. I want to clarify the definition of Gnostic and Astic.
Gnostic and Astic. Gnostic means it's based on the Vedas, or Astic means it's based on the Vedas. And Gnostic means it's not based on the Vedas.
Yeah. So Astic, all the six schools,
they're all based on the Veda. They all accept the supremacy of the Veda.
They are Astic.
Yes. Yes. But simply like Buddhism, Jainism, they don't accept the Vedas, so that's Gnostic. So that's why we make a distinction between those. So in other words, human life begins when you accept the Vedas. And if you don't, it's always going to be subhuman. Though there may be elements in which we will categorize them within. Like we will say within the let's say the modern context, which is non-Vedic. But if there's a belief in God and his laws, we'll say they're theistic. Right, we'll put them into that theistic moralist category, but technically speaking, there how much theism in there is quite limited. In other words, there's that faith in the supreme, and that you have to follow the supreme. But what are the laws of the supreme? How do you define being good? Okay, so someone here says, the Christian on the street says, yes, you should follow God's laws, you should be good. What are those laws? Are they taking from the Bible? You know what I'm saying? Or are they taking, or they're just taking about, if I follow the modern laws given by the government, I'm a good person. But who's made those laws up? Right? So that's the whole point, is that it's limited in its theistic application. Though in faith or in sentiment, they are theistic. But when you actually practically apply it, then the rules that are basing it on aren't necessarily theistic. You know, that's their intent, but it's not technically. So only when you're following the Veda, then that theistic aspect actually is based on the laws of God, and so you're accepting that position, then you can say there's a consistency there. Right? So that then we will say that will be agnostic, right? But they don't really know God's position. So they don't say he doesn't exist, but they don't really know how he exists. Or, in fact, much of the time, they just don't care. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like when you go into the office to get your paper signed by the bureaucrat, do you actually care what he has for lunch or if he likes his lunch or if he even has a lunch? No. As long as he signs your paper, you're good. So, therefore, these six schools acknowledge there's a supreme, he's in control, it's his laws, it's all his shastra, it's all that, and they're willing to follow it. They just want to get the result they particularly want from that practice. It's, they're not worried, is God happy with that? Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, so it's more like, God wants me to be happy, because the soul is Satchitananda, so God wants me to be happy. I'm happy doing this, so doing this makes God happy, right? That's our logical premise. Yes. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the difficulty. Does that make sense? So that's why you see we can talk about these six schools favorably. Mm-hmm. Means, in other words, about the mechanics and its connection to the shastra, and about the correctness of how those mechanics work. And at the same time, if we're talking about actual conclusions, then that's what we'll talk about, that they're bogus. So that becomes confusing, because, you know, it's like it can be used either way. So that's why these other, you know. Does that make sense? Yeah. Six schools. Means you have Gautama, Vaisheshika, Shankhya, Yoga, Jaimini, and
Vedanta.
So, okay.
Maharaj, may you explain, Marisol? I don't understand what you mean, that from what point of view all the six schools of Vedanta are not proper?
Are proper or not proper?
Not proper.
Not proper. Is there any devotion in these six schools?
No, you mentioned the four Vaishnava Sampradayas and the Gaudiya Sampradayas.
But take which context you're going to use here. You have to choose your context.
Mm-hmm.
Don't use one context against the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a car. No, it's an automobile. You know, no, but how can you say it's a car? It's only got, you know, four, three letters, and it's such a big thing. Automobile has so many more. And then you just fight over that it's two different things. A car is not an automobile. You know what I'm saying? So we're either taking the six schools, meaning all these six systems of thought.
Yes.
Right? And we're looking at it from the mechanical aspect of it, that it's all based on the Veda. It's correct.
Yes.
But their conclusion, what they're talking about, that's not necessarily correct.
Yes. And within particular Vedanta, Vedanta school.
So you're talking about Vedanta now, because
yes.
Then, but you said the six schools.
Six.
There's a difference between the six schools.
You said that we have six glimpses on Vedanta, particularly.
Yes. On that, there's six commentaries, but that's what I'm saying. Are you talking about this? Because there we were talking about the six schools, meaning of Vedic philosophy.
No, I asked
the other one is six schools of Vedanta.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
And I not catch, you said that this also within Vedanta, also not all right?
Yeah, I mean Shankara is not right.
But other it's right.
Yes.
And,
yes, because Shankara then also had that tendency towards Shakta element of worship, so that makes it left. Everybody else is right. Okay?
Yeah.
So the four Vaishnava Sampradayas, and then the Gaudiya Sampradaya.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay? Yeah. You have something? No? Oh, okay.
Yes, one more question about particular this four sampradayas.
No, but does that have something to do with this?
Uh-huh.
means, in other words, the topic that's on the floor, is it in pursuance of that, or since I mentioned four sampradayas and you have a question about the four sampradayas because you have an interest in these and want to know more about them, so you're asking the question?
I can't understand even particular one school within Vedanta, four sampradayas have some different points of view and
so what's the problem with that?
And how it can be
here
in all correct in one time?
Tell me which one of those is correct and which one's absolutely and totally bogus. You can also look at it like this.
Particularly, first of all, I heard that Madhva Sampradaya is a...
Be careful. Be really careful. Do you understand? In other words, just this idea that we can throw things around because the words can fall out of our mouth doesn't mean that there's not reactions in the way of picking things up and hitting you over the head. So in other words, every action has a reaction. So if you're going to say something about the Madhvas don't liking the Ramanujas and stuff like that, then you can leave now.
No. I heard that Madhva teaches that there is no existential position of soul, different. Three type of souls.
Madhva doesn't say things like that. That's his followers interpret like that.
So.
That's why Madhvacharya we don't have any problem with. The Tattvavadis we have a problem with. Yeah, three kinds of souls. We also say there's three kinds of souls. There's liberated, there's conditioned, and there's bhagya. Or within the conditioned, souls that are under ignorance, souls that are under goodness, souls that are under passion. That's standard stuff. Yeah, but that's not attributes of the soul. Those are attributes of covering.
Any soul can achieve Krishna. And
yes.
I heard that...
But we already discussed what you heard.
Okay.
You understand?
Yes.
This is not the discussion we're talking about. It's an interest to you. We touched on the point, and so now it's like we just mentioned, you know, the little toll, so then you take the whole thing. Because now it's about your discussion that you have this whole thing about Madhvacharya and this and that and all that. But that's not the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay, the particular difficulties posed by these words will have to be surmounted with special techniques of samanvaya, devised for the purpose. And that is what the sutrakar has done in this pada. Right? So in other words, how you're going to approach it, the logical approach that you're going to use to establish this, then Vyasadeva establishes very specific ways to deal with this. In other words, when you're dealing with this kind of subtleties, then the methods that he's going to present, that's the method.
That's
yes.
Sutrakara would be done by Vyasadeva?
Sutrakara is Vyasadeva. Okay. Because Kara means who wrote the sutras, so that'll be Vyasadeva.
Okay.
Right? And then following the Sutrakara, then Baladev gives the commentary.
Tika.
Yeah.
No, Bhashya.
Tika will be, I think, a commentary on the Bhashya.
Bhashya.
Yes, so it just goes down. Yeah. Okay, Adhikarana 1. Pradhan, the inferred. Anu, mana adhikaranam. Sutra reference 1.4, 1-7. It was shown in 1.1.5 that the Pradhan cannot be the cause of the world, for it finds no support in the scriptures. And further was shown that Brahman alone is the subject of the various doubtful passages of the Upanishads. Still, the Shankhya comes forth with certain passages in which occur terms most familiar to the Shankhya doctrine. This pada especially aims at showing that such terms support not Shankhya doctrine, but the Vedanta doctrine. As such, Sri Baladeva Vidyabhushan opens the pada with the following prayer. Right. So here when we say, because Shankhya is about Vedanta, but we'll call it Shankar because it's the interpretation. So here then we say Vedanta, we means Vyas, and then the five schools of Vaishnava understanding. As such, okay, his prayer. Tama shankhya gano dhiram yasya go ganahi. Tam samvid bhushanam krishna bhushanam samu pash mahe. I worship Krishna, the sun, whose ornament is knowledge, and who, by his rays, has extinguished the darkness caused by many shankhya arguments. Okay. Summary of Adhikarana 1, Vishaya. Previously, the sutras affirmed that the Supreme Brahman is he, the knowledge of whom brings liberation. He who is the seed of the birth, maintenance, and destruction of the material universes, who is different from both the jivas and dead matter, who possesses innumerable inconceivable potencies, who is all-knowing, who possesses all auspicious qualities, who is free from all inauspiciousness, who poses unlimited opulences, and who is supremely pure, right? Because everything he does is in relationship to his devotees. So he is rasa, so it's perfect. So therefore, there cannot be any inauspiciousness, right? Because it's all on that transcendental platform. For the living entity who's conditioned, then they will take these elements of rasa and relations with others, but they will not take them in the transcendental state. They won't see them in connection with the Lord. Therefore, they become incomplete, right? So auspicious means it's complete. Inauspicious means it's incomplete. Right, you go to the store, and you go into the store, pick something up from the store, and then you walk out of the store with that item. Okay, so going into the store, getting things, and walking out, that actually is not a problem. The problem comes down to, did you pay or not? Right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole point. Rasa is rasa. But what's the purpose of it? That's going to be the difference. Does that make sense? So, therefore, you go in, you pay, that's auspicious. You go in, you don't pay, that's inauspicious. Because now you're not considering the relationship with the person who has the store. Right? Because he is the store, he has the goods. Now we take those goods without the relationship with him. Then it's a problem. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point, is that that has to be considered, the whole complete. So Krishna, because he's complete, he sees everything according with everybody, and therefore he performs all his activities with that complete understanding. So everything he does is always auspicious. And the conditioned living entity, technically everything he does, because it doesn't connect to the Lord, is all inauspicious. But if he's willing to follow scriptures in what he does, that's appropriate for the time, place, circumstance. We'll say on the material level, it's materially pious. But on the spiritual level, it's always impious. Right? So Krishna is always auspicious. Because everything he does is always in connection with himself and with the devotees and seeing everything in that way. Okay. Who possesses unlimited opulences and who is supremely pure. Now we will consider the theory that the pradhan, primordial material nature, and the pum, individual living entities, together comprise all that exists, and there is no God separate from them, which is propounded by the Kapila Tantra, and perhaps also seen in some branches of the Vedas. They quote the following passages from the Katha Upanishad. Right? So now they're going to say is that there's only the pradhan and the living entity. There's nothing else. So any concept of God and all that comes up from that combination. But actually, ultimately, there's no need. So this is the atheistic shankhya. Right? Because theistic, what we use is then it's all coming from Krishna, so we don't have this problem. Right? But the Shankarites also is that the living entities will come from illusion, and illusion comes from the living entities. So God, you know, God's something separate. So there's no consideration. Does that make sense? So, but in here, they don't even go beyond. Okay, from Katha Upanishad, the sense objects are higher than the senses. The mind is higher than the sense objects. Intelligence is higher than the mind. The Mahat is higher than the intelligence. The Avyakta, the unmanifested, is higher than the Mahat. The Purusha, the person, is higher than the unmanifested. Nothing is higher than the person. The person is the highest. Shamshaya. The doubt here is whether the word avyakta, the unmanifested, refers to the pradhan, the primordial stage of material nature, or the sharira, the body. So here is then how they're going to interpret this. Purva apaksha. The opponent may answer this doubt by saying that that because both Shruti and Smriti give the sequence at first, as first mahat, then avyakta, and then Purusha, therefore the word avyakta here must refer to the pradhan, right? Because they're taking the Purusha to be the living entity. Mm-hmm. Right? So therefore pradhan must be, I say, lower than that, that higher must be there. Siddhanta, whether the word avyakta refers to pradhan or sharira is explained in the following sutra. Sutra 141. Anumanikam apyeke sham iti chen na sharira rupaka vinyasta grihiter darshayati cha. Anumanikam, the inference, api, even, ake sham, of some, iti thus, chen, if, na, not, sharira, the body, rupaka, the metaphor, vinyasta, placed, grihiter, because of being accepted, darshayati, reveals, cha, and. Though some say that avyakta refers to pradhan, it is not so, because the avyakta represents the body in the previous metaphor of body representing a chariot, and this text shows this. Sutra Prakashika. The Shankya followers of the atheist Kapila Muni argue that the word avyakta in the Katha Upanishad 1.3.10-11 refers to pradhan. The Sutrakar denies this, arguing instead that avyakta refers to sharira, the body. This is shown by referring to the preceding passage from Katha Upanishad, which indisputably uses the term avyakta to refer to the body, right? So therefore, that's what we're talking about in Mimamsa, the context. So something's been repeated. So then, you know, that has an importance. Or they made that point to say that. They went out of their way to establish, it says here, indisputably, that avyakta means the body. So then why would in the next verse it not mean the body? It mean pradhan. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So that's the third category, because usually we do mean avyakta, not the body. But the
No. Here it's about, does avyakta mean pradhan, or does avyakta mean the body? Because avyakta means that you're going to, you've separated all the elements, and so the body's made of these elements. Because pradhan, nothing's made out of pradhan. But avyakta, that's what things are made out of.
Could we say it's made out of mahat?
That's where you actually get around to putting everything together. But the point is that the principle of the avyakta, the unmanifest, then means the aspects of that everything is made out of these 24 elements. You know what I'm saying? No, pradhan's just them all together. Yes, but there's a difference.
But you can say that it's made out of these elements because they're all present.
But then when you only refer to it as pradhan when there's no distinction of the elements.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is if we say body, it's distinct from another body, so it's the distinctness that makes avyakta different from pradhan. Pradhan, there's no distinctness. Avyakta, that means then there's distinctness. So the body means it's distinct.
Mm-hmm. I just don't understand how avyakta can mean the body, in the sense that usually we take the meaning that avyakta is something great, which includes all.
But
the
that, but also mahat is great.
Yeah.
But
pradhan is also great.
Yes, but the no, avyakta means we're taking from that, because what we were bringing out before, and all, basically all our discussions of avyakta was that avyakta at that position. The primordial demigods can't work with it because the Lord hasn't entered it so that everything can be attracted together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the whole point. So they can't do anything with it. So we're only bringing out the point that all the Lord entering it, so then there's going to be that point is there. But then when you add into that the false ego, time, that's where you get mahat. But having the elements that are distinct from each other, and they can either be non-combined or combined, that's still avyakta. Because it's only until you bring in time and false ego, then you'll get mahat.
And how old this can mean the person?
Because the person is made out of avyakta. Because we don't go into areas of definitions we're not used to. So then, just like, it's just like, or first of all, what is all this logic, all this, that, then we get used to it, right? In the three padas. Now in this fourth one, then it expands out, just like we got used to how, things work and the mechanics of things in the first eight cantos, and then the ninth canto then showed us it goes beyond that. Does that make sense? So it's the same thing. It's always, how you say, pushing the limits of our, how you say, philosophical comfort zone. Right. Okay. If one claims that avyakta refers to pradhan, the inferred, an answer is no. Why? Because the text shows this, darshayati, because it gives a simile of chariot compared to the body, with the Atma as the passenger, sharir arupaka vyomasta grihi tehe. This is mentioned before the present text. Atmanam ratinam vidhi shariram ratam evacha. Budhim tu sharatim vidhi saratim vidhi manaf pra graham evacha. Indriyani hayan ahur. Vishayams teshu gocharan admendriya mano yuktam bhoktyet yahur manishinaha. Know the Atma to be the passenger, the body to be the charioteer, the intelligence to be the driver, and the mind to be the reins. The senses are called the horses, and the sense objects are the field of action. The wise say that Atma, joined with senses and mind, is the enjoyer. The worshipper desiring to attain the feet of Vishnu is compared to the passenger seated in the chariot of the body. When he controls the chariot and other factors mentioned, he attains the feet of the Lord after traversing the path. The passenger in question thus indicates lesser or greater importance in regard to controlling the body. The passage in question thus indicates lesser or greater importance in regard to controlling the body and other factors, represented by the chariot and its elements. For instance, indriyebhyah para hyarta, more important than the senses are the sense objects. The senses equated with the horses in the analogy should be equated with the senses and other factors mentioned in the passage in question, because the words are generally the same. The remaining factor to equate with avyakta is the body, since senses, sense objects, mind, intelligence, atma have been correlated. Also, the context indicates this. It does not refer to Shankya philosophy, since it contradicts their theory of elements. In that philosophy, sense objects are not higher than the senses, and intelligence is not an element. Right? So from their understanding, it's there. So therefore, in theirs, it won't deal with this, right? So here is that all the other things have been correlated with different things, but the chariot has not been. So that's the avyakta in the equation. Does that make sense? Okay. So you're having the avyakta, right, the body, but who's controlling all this? Who is going beyond? Who is getting somewhere? Right? The Purusha. Right? Does that make sense? So, pradhan doesn't do anything. Avyakta, then there's the principle of that can act. So therefore, the jiva controlling the whole equation through understanding the principles on which it's based. Right? And if I understand what the... Just like in Gita, you have all the descriptions in the last chapters of what's the mode of goodness, what's passion, what's ignorance. This is you can say is avyakta. This is the unmanifest aspect, mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And so then from that unmanifest aspect, understanding that, then we liberate ourselves. Because if we work on the gross, what the body and all that's doing, that's going to be more difficult. Yes, karma yoga, yes, we can use it. But to liberate ourselves, you have to be able to see beyond that. Right? So one has to see is that these things are there, we're engaging in Krishna's service, that means you have to be able to see it back to the original. So therefore the Purusha, the Jiva, then in actuality, when they bring their consciousness in line with the Supreme Purusha, then they're able to use the elements of this avyakta for service to the Lord. Does that make sense? Yeah. So we're just not, means, because we're always practically applying. So generally the tendency is we're going to emphasize karma yoga, not jnana yoga. Right, so this is the aspect of jnana yoga. But since it's Upanishads, jnana yoga is pretty much the standard. Right, but what we're going to practically apply it in devotional service, so that's why we use buddhi yoga, because there's the aspect of karma, the jnana and jnana. Right? So here's that they're using the jnana. So then, in this way, then, that's how you get to the liberated state, because an action a proper action performed without attachment then gives liberation. So then if you're looking at it just the mechanics of what it does and engage it accordingly to what it should be done, that will be in performing an action in knowledge with detachment. That will give liberation. Does that work? Yes? Better? Okay. Don't worry, we have 6 more of these to go, so it'll start to make sense after a while. Yeah. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Shri Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Sarvanitai Gaurav Premanandini.